Britain is in a deep, in a growth trap, and we will remain in this growth trap. You know, someone says, if you're in a hole, stop digging. What we're doing with net zero is we're just digging harder and harder.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Rupert Dhawal says environmentalism is against economic growth and the green policies allow the ultra-wealthy to feel virtuous.
If you're a multi-billionaire, like, say, Mike Bloomberg, you love it because, again, it doesn't... All what you do to protect yourself from people complaining about your wealth, you say, well, I'm saving the planet.
He says Europe's green push is bringing economic benefit, but not to Europe.
German trade unions were promised... during at the beginning of the so-called Energiewende, there'll be lots of green jobs. And there were, Lee, in China. That's where the green jobs are.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders. I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with Rupert Dhawal, author and senior fellow at the Real Clear Foundation. Rupert, thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be with you.
I was hoping we could talk about green policies and economics and how to kind of understand it all, really. So setting the scene, 2008 was quite a tough year. I mean, we had the financial crisis, but then we also had the Climate Change Act. Yes. And was there a connection between Britain's economic woes and then the introductions of what was arguably the most extreme green policies in the world?
Yeah, what is the case is that the British economy was deeply scarred by the financial crisis and has its trend growth of productivity has basically flatlined since 2008. And as you point out, 2008 is the same year that Parliament passed the Climate Change Act, which as a result saw huge amounts of capital deployed on very low yielding to negative yielding assets in the power generation sector, namely wind and solar. It's very difficult to disentangle the effects, the long-term effects of the financial crisis and the so-called energy transition. But it is unquestionably the case that mandating decarbonisation, very aggressive decarbonisation, worsens the productive potential of the economy. To give you an idea of how bad the energy transition is for and net zero is for growth, the International Energy Agency produced a net zero plan. And in that net zero plan, by 2030, under its net zero assumptions, the global energy sector will be employing 25 million more people, using $16.5 trillion more of capital, $16.5 trillion more capital, using vast land areas of the combined size of Mexico, France, California, and Texas to produce 7% less energy. So the critical thing to understand about the energy transition is it means you need more resources to produce less. So that's exactly what we're seeing.
What effect has the push for renewables had on our energy prices and thus our economy and our competitiveness?
Well, it's made Britain one of the most expensive places in the world for businesses in terms of their electricity bills. We're seeing basically steel making being put out of business in this country. We're seeing oil refining with the Grangemouth oil refinery being closed. The petrochemical industry is going to have a very hard time to survive. So a lot of industry is going to be very bad, is basically going to be wiped out. But then you look at the automotive industry where we have effectively mandates for EV adoption with a rising proportions of car sales must be EVs, otherwise if car manufacturers don't meet those targets, they get taxed, and that will basically lead to almost the obliteration of the British automotive industry, apart from some really, you know, very upscale names like Bentley and so forth. But essentially, you're looking at the death of the British automotive sector.
I was hoping you could give us a layman's introduction to what's happened with wind power in Britain and how what this teaches us about environmentalism. So I know in 2022, Boris Johnson said offshore wind is the cheapest form of electricity in the country. How true was that?
It was a line fed to him by Carbon Brief, which is heavily funded by the European Climate Foundation, which in turn is funded by a very multi billion philanthropic foundations from in the US. It is pure propaganda. There is not any basis for saying that. There was, what one has to remember is that at the time of the energy crisis in 2022, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that around about 40% of the increase of the gas price, natural gas price, was actually artificial carbon taxes and the price of carbon. So take that out. These are completely artificial. This isn't about supply and demand of fossil fuels. This is simply a government imposed taxes to basically tax natural gas production out of the system. I mean, offshore wind is inherently, I mean, if you think about it, putting very large wind turbines in the middle of a hostile marine environment like the North Sea, you need to have a big question mark over it. This defies sort of common sense. And what happened was the wind industry was telling the government, and the government believed, that the cost of offshore wind was about £50 per megawatt hour. In fact, analysis of the accounting data that wind companies, special purpose vehicles, they're all invested through special purpose vehicles, submitted to Companies House, suggests that the break even cost of wind power, break even price, is north of £100 per megawatt hour. So we basically, the wind industry conned the government into saying wind is cheap. And of course, then what's happened? They've now turned around and said, actually, our costs are a lot higher than you thought they would. But you've got the Climate Change Act, which gives a legal duty on the government to reach net zero. So if you don't give us more subsidy, you'll be defying your legal duty to reach net zero. And we just might take you to court to have the courts decide whether you are.
We heard recently about there may be a watchdog investigation into wind farms for overcharging on constraint payments. The constraint payments being getting paid to not produce electricity. Now, can you help us understand the logic behind this? So they get paid to not produce something, then they're overcharging on the nothing.
Yes, the problem is, Lee, it's kind of obvious when you see it that the more wind capacity you have, it means that when the wind's blowing, the more electricity is produced. And that creates two problems. It may be in excess of demand. So you have a sharp fall in the wholesale price of electricity, which incidentally means that gas-fired generators start to be loss-making, and it's very bad for the economics of the power stations that are needed to keep the lights on. So, and it can actually go negative. So you pay them to constrain. The other thing is that the wind turbines are located in remote windy locations, and they have to be connected to the grid, and there's simply not enough grid connection. So the wind operators are saying, well, we need more grid infrastructure. Well, that's not free, but they won't pay for it. They're expecting consumers to pick up the tab, and indeed Ofgem, the energy regulator, has a sort of policy of what they call socialising the cost of grid connection. So they're picked up by customers rather than by the investors, by the capacity that requires the extra grid connections.
So we get people that push the green policies talking about green growth and green jobs. But a lot of the time it seems they don't really materialise, and we end up paying more to produce less in a less efficient way. I mean, is the environmentalism actually an anti-growth strategy?
Well, I think the green jobs have materialised. I mean, if one looked at Germany, for example, the German trade unions were promised at the beginning of the so-called Energiewende, there'll be lots of green jobs. And there were, Lee, in China. That's where the green jobs are. They're not in Europe. I mean, Europe is not competitive. It doesn't have the low energy costs that China has to make this kit. Making this kit is very, very energy intensive. To your point about green growth, I think it's really important to understand that the Greens, since the limits to growth debates of the early 1970s, in fact, limits to growth came out in 1972, Greens have argued that growth, economic growth, will destroy the planet, and therefore growth is bad. Now they're turning around and saying, well, we're going to have green growth. Well, I wouldn't believe that. What you should really believe is that they are against growth and that their policies are designed, have the effect of knocking growth on the head. And kind of that's what we're seeing now.
I mean, growth is generally considered good by most people. Isn't it? Your standard of living goes up, you have quite a nice life. How should we view this kind of degrowth, anti-growth push?
Well, it's very bad news for both, as you point out, for people's living standards, for their aspirations, for their wanting to have a better life for their children than they had for themselves, of having greater opportunities, more enjoyable ways to spend your money, to spend your life. Well, that's true. But also, growth is needed to fund the state and to fund public services. And what we found is that, having had very little growth since 2008, essentially, green policies mean endless austerity. It means extremely high tax rates. The tax burden in Britain is the highest it's been since I think the late 1940s, post-war period. So yes, it's very bad for both for private consumption, but also for public consumption, also public investment. Britain has a very low level of public investment. We have a very low level of private investment. So altogether, what we found ourselves is Britain is in a growth trap, and we will remain in this growth trap. You know, someone says, if you're in a hole, stop digging. What we're doing with net zero is we're just digging harder and harder.
If we look at like Marxist policies, is to take the means of production away from private ownership, whereas what we're looking at now is almost destroy the means of production, reduce the means of production down.
Yeah, that's I often make that point, Lee, that in some respects, environmentalism is a more radical ideology than Marxism. As you point out, Marxism is about changing the ownership of the means of production. This is about changing the means of production themselves. The early Marxists like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, actually, if you look at the Communist Manifesto, there's this great paean of praise to capitalism and the bourgeoisie for creating these fantastic means of production that have unlocked hitherto unforetold levels of prosperity. Of course, as we just discussed, the Greens are very much against that. But where the Greens score is that although it's a radical ideology in terms of changing the means of production and degrading the means of production, it is very socially conservative. It doesn't challenge the existing social hierarchy. So if you're a member of a feudal royal family like King Charles, you like green stuff. It doesn't say dethrone him, cut off their heads. If you're a plutocrat, if you're a multi-billionaire like say Mike Bloomberg in the States, you love it because again, it doesn't. All what you do to protect yourself from people complaining about your wealth, you say, well, I'm saving the planet. I'm using my money. My business and my philanthropy is about saving the planet. So, on the one hand, economically it's very radical, but socially it's all about. It's about maintaining existing social stratifications and, of course, denying people lower down the means to rise up, to better themselves.
So in the kind of original Marxism, the rich guy at the top was the bad guy, but now those rich guys can actually be the good guys in the environmentalism.
Yeah, the way I put it is that green policies and decarbonisation are ethics for the super wealthy. I mean, you see Bill Gates. I mean, he gets asked in interviews, well, what about your carbon footprint? He's got so much money, he pays an enormous amount to have carbon dioxide sucked out of the air, direct air capture. Well, of course, you can do that if you're one of the richest people on the planet. But of course, but for ordinary people, if you're going to expect them when they take their holiday to the Mediterranean to expect them to pay hundreds of pounds extra to take. I mean, it's not going to happen. So yes, this is about the super wealthy feeling virtuous.
Another example of the contradictions would be if we look at, say, wind farms or solar panel farms. They're supposed to be good for the environment, but they're destroying the landscape and they're destroying the habitats and they're chopping up birds. I mean, is it that environmentalism expects us to kind of suspend our beliefs to some degree?
Yeah, this is what you've pointed out is the fundamental contradiction at the deep in the heart of modern environmentalism. It's of the nature to save the village, we had to destroy it. So you're absolutely right. What it means is sacrificing local habitats, and obviously upland, you know, hillsides and so forth. That's where you get a lot of raptors, birds of prey. Wind farms are very bad for birds of prey. They're very bad for migrating birds. They are terrible for bats. Bats avoid because of their they avoid the rotating blades, but the blades have these very high pressure shocks that explode their lungs. They are terribly bad for insects. They destroy insects. Of course, a lot of bird life is feed off insects. So yes, it has a terrible effect on nature, on animals. And bird life in the sea, there is evidence to suggest it's very bad for whales and off the northeast, the Atlantic coast of the United States. There's a lot of concern about near extinct right whales being killed by offshore wind farms. And what is absolutely clear is that the environmentalists don't care about this. They fundamentally don't care about it because normally it's about the precautionary principle. So you've got to be extra specially careful, but not when it comes to wind power. They're perfectly okay with wind power destroying nature.
So is it, they see it as like a greater good, like we need to ruin some of the planet to save the greater planet.
That's right. I think the error is that as soon as you go from the local to the global, you sacrifice the local. And of course, the global is an aggregate of the local. But for them, it isn't. So it's this monomaniacal obsession with carbon dioxide emissions, which has led to this tragedy, I think, for nature, that so much is being destroyed in the name of saving nature, which it won't do.
When Rishi Sunak was Chancellor, he talked about rewiring the global financial system for net zero and redeploying $130 trillion of assets. Can you help us understand how that would be possible and tell us about the role that ESGs play in all of that?
Yes, that was he made that speech he gave at the Glasgow Climate Conference. In my opinion, Lee, it's the single worst speech ever given by any Chancellor of the Exchequer of either party. I mean, it was an absolutely appalling speech because essentially he's saying private savings should be socialised to meet public policy objectives. And ESG is very much a part of the socialisation of private savings. ESG is basically politics by other means. It's so that instead of government saying, we're going to pass laws and regulations and raise taxes and spend lots of money ourselves doing it, we are going to pass regulations and we're going to browbeat business to do this for us. Now, there's a twofold cost in that. One is to investors whose capital is being basically expropriated, is being used by politicians, and the other is to consumers who pay higher prices as a result of that. So yes, ESG is a very, in my view, very malign trend in finance. It's very interesting if you look what's been happening in the United States, where it's in retreat for basically two reasons. Because, first of all, because the anti-ESG stocks, if you like, or the oil and gas sector suddenly in the COVID recovery suddenly put on great growth spurt in the stock market. So if you were out of oil, if you weren't in oil and gas stock, you lost out. And secondly, there's been a big reaction in Republican states against these ESG mandates. However, in Britain and Europe, ESG continues. The government is mandated, effectively, it's telling businesses they have to come up with net zero transition plans. So ESG is alive, well, and doing a lot of damage in Britain and Europe.
So in the US, we saw Texas divest about $8 billion, I think it was, dollars. Yes. from BlackRock because of their ESG measures. I mean, do you think we will see anything like that here, or is that very much an American approach?
Yeah, it's very much, it shows the, if you like, the strength and vibrancy of capitalism in America. There is not a peep of that in the UK or Europe. Britain's largest asset manager is Legal & General, and it is completely signed up to the net zero ESG agenda. There's very, very little sign of a backlash. Local authorities tend to be green. They want to, they invest their pension funds in sort of nice ESG ways. You have the university superannuation funds. I mean, look at universities. They're all kind of, they're kind of green and woke and so forth. So there is unfortunately very little sign of that. All that you've seen is that the London stock market is until recently, until the last few weeks or so, has performed, massively underperformed the S&P 500 in the States.
It seems we're seeing this contradiction again, but this time if I invest some money in a big investment firm, I'd expect them to use it to make money, but instead they're using it for ideological means.
Yeah, ESG, the ESG sales pattern was doing well by doing good. So what they said is, we'll use your money to do good, and by the way, you will make more money doing that than you otherwise would. That was always rubbish. That was it defied modern financial portfolio theory. But they got away with it until around about 2022, when oil stocks had a very strong run on the stock market. The other thing to point out, Lee, is that ESG is such a ESG used to be, you can't have any defence stocks because armament manufacturers are evil and so forth. Then Putin invades Ukraine, and they suddenly wake up and say, "Well, actually, we should have defence contractors in there." So it's also a completely muddled, ill-defined, ill-defined concept that is kind of made up as it goes along.
It's almost like, arm stocks are bad, but not if you use them for the battles that we want to fight. So it kind of becomes a two-edged morality almost.
Yes, there's that. And there's also, why should it be fund managers taking these really important decisions? This is actually, you know, things like defence and national security are preeminently their decisions and policies for politicians, not for people in the city.
So you've very much got your finger on the pulse of kind of green and economic issues. Are there any things coming up that you think we should keep an eye out for that are going to surprise us in the coming year?
I think the big thing will be what happens in the American elections in November. You have, on the one hand, you have the Biden administration, which has a net zero, set itself a net zero policy goal. It's the EPA is making a rule which will really take coal off the grid. It will cut massively the amount of natural gas power they've got on the grid. Biden has imposed a moratorium on new permits for this export of natural gas. On the other hand, you have Trump, who believes in what he calls American energy dominance. He's a hydrocarbon politician. He's actually, I would say, the only Western leader of the last couple of decades who is what I call an energy realist, who really understands energy. He pulled out of in his first term, if there is a second term, his term as president, he pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. I think he would do the same again. And if that happens, I think it will raise a huge question mark about, what is the sense of persisting with net zero if the biggest, second largest emitter in the world pulls out of the Paris Agreement? I mean, I think it really kills net zero to anyone intelligent looking at it.
Well, we already had India and China not really buying into it in the first place, but yeah, for America to join them.
Yes. Well, the thing about the conceit of the structure of the Paris Agreement is these nationally determined contributions. So what China and India have been doing is they're not pledging any cuts. They say, well, the carbon intensity of our economy will decline over time, which it will do anyway. One of the interesting facts of Britain that people, you know, when Rishi Sunak and British politicians boast about Britain cutting its carbon emissions, Britain's CO2 emissions peaked in 1972. So, you know, as economies mature, they tend to become less carbon intensive. I mean, that's been the case in Britain. What has happened since 2008, as we discussed at the beginning of this, is that that has been massively accelerated, with quite a lot of damaging effect on manufacturing, on energy prices, on grid reliability, and so forth.
If Trump did get in and pulled out of the agreement in that way, do you think the UK will follow along or oppose? What do you think will happen here?
I think what would happen here is I don't think a Starmer government, particularly given Ed Miliband in the position of Energy Secretary, who was Energy Secretary when the 2008 Climate Act was passed. He was at the Copenhagen conference in 2009 and played quite an important part there. There is no way they are going to have second thoughts on it. But I think what will change, or what could change, is the Conservatives in opposition. They might actually begin to smell the coffee and say, actually, this is a really bad idea. Net zero costs us vote. It costs people money, and therefore we need to question it. So I think it will change the dynamic of politics in this country, particularly if Trump were to repeat what he did between 2016 and 2020.
Do you think in like 5 years' time we could be seeing an opposition Conservative Party that's against a lot of the green policies and quite different from what it is now?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's a possibility. The problem is that when a party goes into opposition, quite often, I mean, it happened in 1997, essentially the Conservative Party had a collective nervous breakdown and gave up on conservatism. That's essentially what happened. And it went through that long period of sort of, and it was completely enamoured with Tony Blair and the promise of David Cameron and George Osborne. Their whole thing was, well, we are going to emulate Tony Blair and we're going to get the Conservative Party to love the leftward drift of British politics. Will that happen again? Well, Keir Starmer's no Tony Blair, is he? So, but on the other hand, the ability of the Conservative Party to really screw things up should never be underestimated.
Rupert Dowell, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.